Hi, this is Martin Fowler, and you're listening to The Agile Uprising.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Colleen Johnson, and today we're joined by Jeff Gotthelf, author of Lean UX and his new book, Sense and Respond. I'm here with Andrew Leff from the Agile Uprising. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Colleen.
Hi, Colleen.
And welcome, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So, Jeff, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you entered into the world of design and product discovery?
Absolutely. I was a designer. Actually, I was a broke musician, to be perfectly honest. And I was tired of being a broke musician. And so I decided that the internet was the future. There was gold in them hills. And so I moved into front-end development and web design. This was in Web 1.0. So front-end development meant markup. And I spent time as an information architect, as an interaction designer, and then ultimately as a design team leader. And about 10 years ago, I was tasked with building a design team at a company in New York that was transitioning to an agile way of working. And my job was not only to build a team, but also to build a practice that worked, a design practice that worked with agile engineering. Now, there were no good answers about how to do that 10 years ago. And there were, there was animosity towards those two things working well together. And anybody who had tried doing any kind of design in an agile environment really felt like the two things could not work well together. And yet, that was still the challenge I had to solve. And so with the help of a sympathetic executive, we were able to experiment with our processes over time and figure out a solution that worked for us. And I started speaking and writing about that solution, which we ended up calling Lean UX. And that turned into a book. And that book really took that concept and that conversation global. And it changed the trajectory of my career from being a product designer and a design team leader to being much more of a, I played more in the product management world, ultimately moving into product discovery, and then really trying to start to build this kind of more of a holistic, agile approach to software development and really kind of a lowercase agile, lowercase A for agile, this cross-functional, collaborative, customer-centric approach to product development. And what's happened over the years is that the feedback from the folks who have read Lean UX has been tremendous. And we've learned a ton from it. And the feedback has been, we really want to work this way. We love working this way. This is the way that we, as the makers of product, want to work. But my boss will let me work this way. Or my company doesn't work this way. Or our incentive structures don't incentivize us to actually build something usable. We just have to build something, period. Not necessarily usable or anything along those lines. And so to me and to my co-author, Josh Seiden, that presented an opportunity to say, can we have a bigger conversation? Can we take a conversation that started with designers and product managers and engineers and take it to an executive level and say, your teams want to work differently. Here's why, and here's how to create the kind of organization and leadership and management style that supports this way of working. And the culmination of that was our most recent book, Sense and Respond.
That's great. So when you're sort of talking about sort of how you got to where you are, what would you say would be the, maybe this is a too big of a question, but the biggest misconception about product discovery today?
I think the misconceptions are the pushbacks, right? They're the reasons that people resist this. And so the misconceptions are that it's time intensive, that it's expensive. I had an engineer on one of the teams that I'm coaching with just last week say, why do we have to do another round of learning? Can't we just build something? Right. And that's a prevalent mentality, right? Not just from engineers, but from managers, right? This learning stuff is great. This discovery stuff is great, but I got to ship features. And so, why do my engineers have to talk to customers? All of these are all the pushbacks that I get, and they're all born of misconceptions of the process, that this is a thing that is done strictly by researchers or designers or even product managers, that it's labor intensive and costly, that it delays shipping, and that it's time that is probably better spent writing code. And those are, you know, that's where I spend the bulk of my time, is convincing organizations and teams that this is not the case.
So when you're talking about that, because as coaches in the industry as well, it's sort of a tricky thing to get, you know, to meet the client where they're at, but also try and move them forward. You know, what sort of techniques or, you know, conversations do you have to help bridge that gap, to build those bridges, to make people more comfortable when they're already uncomfortable with the change?
The whole transformation, in my opinion, hinges on being able to shift both the leadership and the team's mentality to from working towards outputs to working towards outcomes. That's the key to this entire transformation, in my opinion. That's the pivot point. There's lots of tangential stuff that comes off of that pivot, but when a team, when a manager, when an organization can shift the way that they think from my job is to ship features to my job is to change customer behavior, everything follows from there. That's the key mindset shift. And so I work with teams to redefine their work. So for example, you take a team that's building an e-commerce app, right? And we say, okay, you guys are the app team. Let's change that. You're no longer the app team. You're the mobile commerce team. Okay. Now, if you're the app team, your incentive and your goal is to ship the app. That's it. That's what we work towards. But if you're the mobile commerce team, your job is to change your customer's mobile commerce behavior. And so it's terrific. So that could be an app. It could be beacons. It could be augmented reality. It could be 1,000 different things, right? All of a sudden, what we've done is we've given the team a constrained space within which to do product discovery and an objective measure of success that says your job is to drive up mobile commerce by 15%, right? Now, the interesting thing is at the management level to have that conversation is to what we've done there very, very subtly perhaps is we've redefined done. We've redefined success. Whereas teams that manage to output, their definition of done is I shipped the feature and it works as designed, right? That's it. Teams that manage to outcomes, shipping is the beginning of the process. It's the beginning of the learning process, the beginning of the conversation with the customer and with the market. And you don't actually get to done until you shifted customer behavior in a way that you've defined for yourself in advance of the project, like, you know, 15% increase in mobile commerce, return visits, bounce rates, retention rates, that type of thing. And so it's those are the conversations that I try to have. Now, I get a lot of head nods and a lot of, yeah, totally get it. Yeah, the customer, that's really great. But I'm on the hook for this feature by Thursday. So that's what I'm going to manage for. And that's what people get incentivized for. And that's, to me, that's the biggest obstacle and the best conversation to start with as well.
And it sounds like, so there's a balance here between measuring output and measuring how to do that discovery work up front for an organization that's new to putting these principles into place. Do you have suggestions on how to tie those two together or how to bridge the gap?
Yeah. So here, measuring is exactly the challenge here. So measuring output is simple. It's binary. Period. You shipped it or you didn't. That's it. And because it's easy to measure, it's easy to manage, it's easy to incentivize, right? Did you ship the app by Thursday? Yes, we did. Great. You get your bonus or you get to do the next thing, whatever it is. When you switch to outcomes, that conversation all of a sudden becomes a lot less clear, a lot more muddy, because let's say I tasked you with increasing mobile commerce by 15% and you worked for a quarter and you increased it by 9%. Did you succeed? Did you fail? It's more difficult. It's a more difficult conversation to have. It's a more difficult management decision to make. And so the goal here is to reduce cycle time, to increase learning, and to provide the leadership of these teams with as much transparency and evidence as to what the team is doing to help them make the best management decision, right? So in the absence of a binary decision process, you have the option, you have the responsibility as a team, if you want to work this way, to come back to your leaders on a regular basis, right? Let's say it doesn't have to be at the end of every sprint necessarily, but maybe it's at the end of every month or at the end of every quarter, depending on the scope of your initiative, and say, here's what we've been working on. Here are the experiments that we've run, the discovery work that we've done. Here's what we've shipped. Here's what we've learned. Based on that, we've moved mobile commerce up by 4%. Okay, our goal is 15. And based on what we've learned, for the next cycle, sprint, month, quarter, whatever, here's what we plan on doing. Now, as an executive, as a leader, now all of a sudden you have fact. You have evidence that says this team's making good progress. They're learning some things. And we should give them another cycle to keep moving this forward. Or, you know what? This is a futile effort. Let's move them on to something else. And the team actively participates in that conversation as well, right? Because let's say, again, we're gonna use a 15% mobile commerce idea. Maybe at the end of my cycle, I come back to you as the executives and say, you know what, we hit it. We hit 15% increase. What do you wanna do next? Or we come back and we say, hey, guess what? We're never gonna hit it. It's never gonna happen. Here's why. Like, we've learned over and over and over again that customers don't wanna do this. We sell yachts, right? So driving up a 15% increase in mobile yacht sales, it's not gonna happen, right? And so that's how you start to kind of bridge this gap and reduce the discomfort with leaders who are so used to kind of saying, well, did you ship it on Thursday, right? So that's the start of the conversation.
So Jeff, how does all of this relate to lean and agile practices from a process perspective?
Well, lean and agile practices are perfectly designed to accommodate product discovery, continuous learning, and continuous improvement. In fact, they advocate for it. And it's the you know, the way that I teach it in my workshops and in my coaching and in my trainings and everything else is this. Agile provides us with a framework of values and rituals for short cycles, accountability, high accountability, and reflection. Lean provides, to me, in many ways, a really nice decision-making framework from the values that it brings to market. And the two key values that I like to take away from Lean, and this, you know, you know, it's a massive subject, but the two key things that I like to take away from Lean and that I think form the basis for an excellent decision-making process framework for agile teams is that you are always moving from a position of doubt to a position of certainty. And this is particularly true in software. And to reduce the risk of going too far in any direction that might be wrong, we work in small batches, right? And that's kind of the agile cycle thing. And so we want to reduce waste by not going too far in the wrong direction. But we have this humble mentality that says we might be wrong. And so we're never going to go too far before we pause and reflect on what we've learned and then decide, did we collect enough evidence to green light another cycle in the same direction? And if we did, that's all you've greenlit. Let's be clear, right? This is where I see teams fall off the wagon very quickly, right? Is if you go through a cycle, whatever your cycle is, a sprint, a month, whatever, right? And if at the end of that cycle, you've collected enough evidence that convinces you that you're still on the right track, the only thing that you have now you have a green light for is the next cycle. Not the next 18 months, not the next, you know, 3 years of dev work, the next cycle. And if at any point when you do your reflection, you have evidence to the contrary that says this might not be the best direction to continue in, then you have to very critically look at your data and decide whether you're going to pivot, right? So try a different tactic, maintain the strategy, or if you're going to kill the idea. And that is being agile. That's agile. That's lowercase a. That's agility, right? It's not the religion, the capital A religion aspect of it. And when you give teams, so here's how it all ties together. When you give teams an outcome to achieve, right? Essentially a customer behavior to influence, they have to discover the right combination of code, copy, and design that helps customers achieve that. And it's through those short cycles where they pick a direction and they say, we're going to go this way. And we go this way for a sprint. And at the end of that sprint, we say, okay, what have we learned in our product discovery and delivery efforts over that sprint? Is this still the right direction? And again, our measure of success is not how many lines of code we've written, but are we more likely to influence customer behavior to achieve the outcome, right? And if so, let's keep going. And if not, we're going to change course. And that's where all this, so managing the outcomes encourages exploration. Sprints time box the amount of exploration and product discovery that you do. And then kind of that lean thinking says, well, we don't want to go too far in the wrong direction. So what evidence have we collected that tells us that we should continue to go down this path? And so the ideas play really, really well together in that sense.
I'm curious your the approach of moving from doubt to uncertainty in small batches. What does that do for the very typical enterprise practice of annual roadmap planning?
Yeah, that's so. I got a whole chapter about that in our new book. But essentially, the recommendation is so. There's two things at play here. There's roadmaps, and then there's financial planning. Roadmaps are security blankets. They are the manager's security blanket, right? They're like, if somebody comes and asks me what the team is doing, I can say, well, we've got a 12-step roadmap. They're on step 4. Next week, they'll be on step 5. And by Thursday, they'll be on step 10, right? So as a manager, I have concrete facts to give to my manager, except it's BS, right? It might be true. It may not be true. It's our best guess. And as we know, software development is complex and unpredictable. And in all likelihood, those roadmaps inevitably end up wrong. And so instead of feature-based roadmaps, we do outcome-based roadmaps that says, look, for the next quarter, our goal is mobile commerce. Now, mobile commerce, we know that the drivers of an increase in mobile commerce are things like bounce rates off of mobile pages, return visits, and geo-sensitive targeting. Like when people are in the right space at the right time, we sell more stuff of whatever it is that we sell. And so now we've got behavioral criteria that we can optimize for over the course of a quarter. And at the end of that quarter, we kind of come back and we report back on our progress towards driving mobile commerce and the kind of the more tactical optimization efforts of the teams. And we can determine whether or not optimizing for these three types of behaviors is the right thing to continue doing, or if we should try something else. Now, the nice thing about that is that in the same way that that provides us with a roadmap, although a slightly shorter time frame for those roadmaps for the year, it also provides evidence for financial planning. And so instead of saying, you have $1 million for 2018 to build the app, right? We could say, you have $1 million in 2018 to drive mobile commerce. We're going to give you $250,000 at a time. And at the end of every quarter, you have to justify your refunding, essentially. It's very much like a startup in that sense, in that you have a quarter's worth of budget to do this work. And at the end of that quarter, the evidence that you present us will not only determine the direction that the team goes in, but whether or not we continue to fund this particular effort. And again, the beauty of this is that the team may come back at the end of a quarter and say, we did it. And now we've got 750 grand left in the bank. What do you want to do with that 750 grand? Right? Whereas in the past, we would have spent that $1 million on an app. No questions asked. And so it's retraining the organization, again, to reduce your cycle time, to increase your learning loops, and to make evidence-based decisions. You can still do the annual planning of budgets, right? But to pretend that you can predict in a software-based world what that money will be used for is a fool's errand.
So when we're talking, when you sort of walk us through that thought process, it's interesting. So, you know, as we all want to promote sort of those better practices, and if we're utilizing some of the Agile framework or the Agile framework, you know, where do the Agile methodologies fall short, and do you describe any of those practices in your book, and sort of can you sort of walk us through that thought process or your opinion on that?
Absolutely. The book is a synthesis of kind of a lot of modern methodologies into a framework for management and for leaders. And so, yes, we talk about Agile, and we talk what we really try to get out of the technical language of things in the book itself. But that said, the reason that certainly the companies that I work with, the reason that many of the companies, or most of the companies that I see, that they are quote unquote hiring Agile today, is not the reason it was created, at least not as it's described in the manifesto, right? Today, companies are hiring Agile for throughput, to drive productivity. And so there's a hyper-focus on velocity. And velocity means features and output, right? How much stuff can we get out in this time box? Great, I get more stuff out in that same time box. And really trying to figure out how to drive an increase in the production capabilities of the team rather than the ultimate success of the customer. And that's the other thing that I think people struggle with, is that if people who bring Agile into their organization and kind of take it at its I don't want to say purest form, but you know, kind of in the traditionalist sense, if you will, forgive me. See the customer as an internal customer. And the conversation that I have with teams that we have in our books is about the end user as customer. And so those are the two biggest challenges that I see with modern Agile implementations reconciling with the framework that I just described to you a second ago. It's that teams are incentivized for, optimizing their velocity and increasing it. And all that it's about is getting features out the door. And we are not building software factories. That's not the right mindset for teams. We're building complex systems. And you have to be agile to react to the learnings that come back from these complex systems.
So it's interesting when you were talking about that, you sort of mentioned leadership, and it's always a buzzword for me, especially going into an organization that, you know, is not as mature in their sort of transformation, if we have to call it something. So I'm going to throw the it seems to be the popular conversation these days, at least on the blogs and internet. So sort of, so scaling, you know, how does the lean UX practice scale? How do you fit into that sort of, where do you see that piece of it falling into some of the scaling frameworks that are out there? Does it matter? Sort of, what's your opinion on that?
Yeah. So I gave a really great talk about this, in my opinion, of course, great talk. I gave a talk. That was a not so humble brag. both at Mind the Product last year in London, and again at Webstock earlier this year in New Zealand, two variations on the same theme, and the videos should be up for both of those talks. Scaling processes inevitably leads to rigidity and a lack of agility. If we want these ideas to work at scale, we have to scale the values underneath them. And it's things like humility and continuous improvement and customer centricity and valuing learning as much as we value delivery, and bringing those into our culture and the way that we work. So philosophically, that's how these ideas work at scale. Now, I get it, right? I mean, I could say that all the time, but the reality is when the rubber hits the road, what are my teams supposed to do today? And so, again, I'll come back to my central thesis that managing to outcomes is the pivot point around which this all works. And so the challenge, of course, then is, if let's say you have five teams And we'll get to bigger scale than that in just a second. But if you have five teams and each one of those teams is optimizing for a different outcome, they're going to optimize locally. And they may optimize to the detriment of the other four teams because, again, their incentive is you got to make this thing happen. And, you know, I'm sorry that it's not stuff, bad stuff's happening over there, but I'm going to get my bonus over here. So the first step to scaling these principles is to take that set of teams, whether it's five teams or 10 teams or whatever it is, and give them the same success criteria, the same outcome. All of a sudden, we can now apply the Agile principles of self-organization into that process. We say, look, these seven teams win or lose together based on the amount of increase in mobile commerce. Now you've got seven teams who have to coordinate with each other about everything that they're doing, everything that they're learning, the code that they're writing, the designs that they're working on. You know, and so they've got to figure out how to work well together because they've got to succeed or, you know, win or lose together. And so as you start to scale that up, that becomes the unifying principle. There is customer behavior. And then how many teams you assign to a specific customer behavior really depends on the complexity of your industry, your customer, the behavior that you're trying to elicit, and so forth. But that helps to start to scale these principles. You can still keep, you know, the basic frameworks in place, short cycles, stand-ups, retros, you know, product discovery activities, and so forth. But let the teams figure out how to leverage that with the responsibility on them being, you are going to be transparent about the progress that you're making, the challenges that you're having, what you're learning, and how we can become better at this over time. And that's the key. And it works. It certainly works at five teams. It works at 20 teams. It works at 50 teams. Does it work at 100 or 300 teams? You know, it certainly the complexity becomes more challenging at that level.
Makes sense.
Really. Jeff, you have a really popular Medium post out there that's called Agile Doesn't Have a Brain. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Yeah, this is kind of the continuation of the conversation we were just having. Agile was invented by software engineers. And in my experience, every single Agile transformation or Agile adoption that I've ever come across has started with the IT group. Like, it's never been the marketers. We're being like, hey, we should be Agile, right? It's always starts in software engineering. And because of that, and because of this drive towards velocity and throughput, we as in the companies that I work with and the people that I come in contact with, have built excellent software engineering teams that are incentivized for the efficient delivery of high-quality code. And high-quality means bug-free. And that's the kind of software engineering organizations that are being built, particularly inside non-digitally native companies like banks and insurance companies and things like that. What we failed to give these teams is a decision-making framework to help them determine what to work on and when it's done. Right? That's the brain. Right. So that's a quote that I borrowed from my friend Bill Scott, who's a VP of engineering at PayPal. And you know, Bill's been a UX guy. He's been a designer. He's been an engineer. He's been around forever. One of the smartest people I know in the field. And, you know, so full credit where it's due. But the point is that you've got this great production engine that has not been given a clear sense of how to decide what to work on. And so that's where this product discovery bit, this, you know, and lean, frankly, fits really nicely on top of that, because it forces us to change our measure of success, and it forces us to go find the right combination of features and copy and design that help us achieve that success. And yes, that will slow down the velocity of delivery, but it will drive up the velocity of learning. And I think that that's the key. And I've been saying this a lot to my clients lately, is this, right? If you've got 100%, if you're focused 100% on the velocity of delivery and 0% on the velocity of learning, as you increase your learning, your product discovery, your experimentation, your customer conversations, et cetera, the velocity of delivery is going to come down. It's a balance, right? There's only so many people, so many hours in the day, right? So there's a balance here, and that's okay. because we want to make sure that we're actually working on things that make sense. We don't want to spend time building things that people don't want. That's the key here. And so that's what I mean when I say Agile doesn't have a brain, or when Bill said it as well, is that we need to give people this customer-centric, outcome-based process for deciding how to prioritize.
And do you find that it requires a different type of team member, whether that's engineering or product design, to be successful in a more outcome-focused team?
Or to make it requires a mindset. You need the cross-functional collaboration, so product management, design, and engineering at the very least, right? And then whoever else, but at the core, it's at least product design and engineering. But you need that mindset, that exploratory, Astro Teller calls it enthusiastic skepticism in his TED talk about Google X, right? You're looking for that quality in your teammates that say, I have a good idea about how to solve this, but in the face of evidence, I'm willing to change my mind. That's humility, it's curiosity, enthusiastic skepticism. And so it's a mindset shift. And look, I've met really excellent engineers. I'm talking to one last week, and he said, look, I trust my product managers. Just tell me what to build. I'm really good at building stuff. I don't want to do anything else. I don't want to talk to customers. I don't want to leave my cube. I just want to put my headphones on and I want to write code. And that's a really interesting teaching moment for an organization. Because if you're going to invest in product discovery, if you're going to shift to outcome-based management, you're going to come across people like that. They're not bad people. They're not bad at their job. But their skill set and their mindset may not fit the new reality you're trying to create. And so in those situations, you're faced with a fairly tough decision. Do you find positions for these folks that allow them to do what they do really well and keep them there? Or do you part ways with these folks? And it's a fair conversation, because if you're trying to build or evolve your culture and you've got these kind of legacy attitudes, and again, I don't mean to make it sound like they're negative, right? But there's just people who just don't want to work this way. And that's, again, nothing wrong with that at all. But do they stick around? Do you actively part ways with them? Do you wait for the attrition to take place? Those are all tough and real conversations that companies need to have as they shift towards this way of working. And I think it's largely ignored.
So sort of when you're talking about some of those conflicts, you know, dealing with, you know, individuals or organizations, in your opinion, sort of what's some of the biggest disagreements or challenges that you see between designers and development teams today?
It's interesting. So the one of the biggest ones is, I don't want to do this with you. Like, why are you asking me to come in here and sketch pictures with you? Isn't that your job? Usually from engineers to designers, right? And the designer's coming back and saying, why do I have to regularly convince you that what I've learned out in the field is true? That's a colossal waste of my time, right? To me, the far more interesting conversation between designers and developers is, here are the facts. What do we do about it? And unfortunately, I can tell you this from the first half of my career, I spent 10 years of my life, having the crappier version of that conversation, which is, here's what I saw out in the field, and this is what we should do about it. And then they're like, well, actually, I don't believe you that took place, or you tested it wrong, or, well, we've already built this much of it, so we're not going to give up on it, right? And that's a far less productive and much less collaborative conversation than, hey, we were all there. We saw these three customers unable to complete the task in our workflow. What do we do about it? So that's kind of the biggest push and pull, is who does what and how often, and to what extent do we all have to do all the stuff together all the time? And there's no silver bullet here. There's a balance of activities here, but that's a big part of it. And I think that the more, frankly, and I'm going to tread on the precipice of a massive can of worms here, but we don't have to go down that rabbit hole. But I think that the more that designers can speak confidently about code, the more effective those conversations can be, the more convincing and compelling designers can be in pulling developers into their a bit further away from the day-to-day of code writing and more into the product discovery work. I'm not saying that that engineers could do the same by getting into the design and UX principles as well, but sharing, having a common language is extremely beneficial. But that's the biggest, that's the biggest challenge of push and pull is that. And then the other thing too is dedication. For some reason, most organizations that I come across and that I work with have no issues dedicating engineers to a project. But for some reason, that can't be the same for designers. Now, naturally, there are fewer designers in almost all organizations than engineers. But that said, when you start to break up those designers, they have less time to build up that kind of camaraderie and trust and shared language with their engineering colleagues. And they simply have less time to do the work. And so sometimes they need just enough to keep the team going. And then so they can move on to the other project as well. And that's a root cause of some of those collaboration breakdowns.
Yeah, that's good. That makes sense. Sorry, Colleen.
That's right. When you talk about where to start inside of an organization and that balance between the designers and the developers, where do you go to look for an internal advocate, or where have you seen the most strength in an internal advocate in an organization?
I'll tell you who I target, especially in a large organization. I always target the newest executives. The people who are fresh in from somewhere else.
New blood.
Yes. Yes. Because of a couple of reasons. One is they've got that kind of new kid street cred, right? And so they've got that political capital that they can spend and blame on being the new person. Oh, I'm the new guy. I didn't know. That was your world that I just, stepped in. That's part of it. Second is they don't have any of the political agenda that people who have been there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years may have, or that they've been working towards. So that's also helpful. And third, typically the reason new people are hired into executive roles is because they bring fresh thinking. And in my experience, many of these newer executives, particularly in large companies, come from organizations that are further down the path of digital transformation and digital adoption and agile adoption and lean thinking and so forth, customer centricity. And so in my career, that's been my most successful tactic as an in-house employee or as a consultant, is to find those enlightened executives. And typically they're, max 2 or 3 years into the business. They've come from a more enlightened organization, and so they're just willing to take risks, and so that's been my strategy.
No, that's it's good to hear. Some of the other areas sort of struggle with some of the same challenges that we all feel dealing with change and trying to evolve sort of that cultural change. So around trying to push that needle forward, how do you know when you've gotten there? And I'll use the air quotes, or, achieve success with the outcome first, maybe culture isn't changing first. How do you create those short-term wins?
To some extent, hopefully you're seeing product success, right? I mean, that's why we're doing this in the long run, is to make the products, the services better, and the companies more successful. So hopefully you can point to some of that as a result of a change in the way that we're working. But the other thing I do, and I do this a lot with executives recently, is I use the same framework that I use to help define hypotheses, experiments, and outcomes for products. We use the same framework on process change. So instead of saying, what is the change in customer behavior that you'd like to see, we talk about the change in employee behavior that you'd like to see. And we talk about ways that we think we could elicit that kind of change. And then we talk about experiments that we could run to test whether those particular process changes achieve those outcomes. And that's been a really interesting and effective way to introduce people both to process change and to these new concepts, because it's low risk, right? So I don't come into an organization and say, you've got to change everything. All 40,000 people have to work a whole new different way tomorrow, right? It's more like saying, look, let's take a team and let's give that team a new goal to work towards for the next month. And let's just leave them alone and see what happens. Right. And so all of a sudden we've got and we will know that this was a successful experiment when we see what employee morale, productivity. I don't know. Right. Stuff like that. And we measure that stuff. We benchmark it before, we measure it after. And we, even if it's a qualitative metric initially, at least it gives us a sense of whether or not we're positively impacting our employees as well.
Is it important to define that metric that you're shooting for up front?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Now you might be wrong about it, but you got to take a guess, right? So if we build cross-functional teams targeting outcomes who are encouraged to do product discovery, we will know that this is a better way of working when we see attendance at meetings, you know, go up, the number, the quality of applicants, you know, rise and attrition go down, right? Because we're hemorrhaging people right now. You may use those and benchmark those before the process experiment starts. And along the way, you realize that applicant quality is going to take 12 months for you to impact, right? So let's not measure applicant quality anymore, because there's no way we're going to impact it, right? So, but yes, you've got to set some kind of benchmark up front so that you know if you're making any progress against it. And I think that you've got to be realistic with yourself, and this is true for any outcome, whether it's process or product based, is that that is also a guess. It's also an assumption, and you might be measuring the wrong thing, and that's a fair conversation to have.
You also mentioned time boxing those experiments. You used the example of 1 month. Do you ever go in a different way to constrain the experiment to get more buy-in from executives, like with a dollar amount, or do you find time boxing it best?
Yeah, I like time boxes the best. Look, to make anything palatable, and any kind of big change palatable to an organization, to leadership inside an organization, you want to reduce the risk of it. And so I think time boxing, time is money in an organization, right? If I take 6 people for a week, they cost me $30,000. If I take them for a month, they cost me $120,000, right? So I think they're essentially one and the same. And so if I can say, look, give me 2 weeks, give me this team, let me take this team for 2 weeks or a month or whatever it is, that sort of becomes a very, as opposed to me saying, give me $60,000 of this team's time. Right, like if we're an agency, right? If we're a services company, maybe that's a very clear sense of what I'm asking for. But generally, if you're in-house, I'll say, look, I want this team for a month, right? Give me Jeff's team for a month. We're going to work with them to do this, and our goal is to achieve X, Y, and Z. And we will report back 30 days from today with exactly what we've learned and what kind of progress we made to determine if this was if this is worth continuing to invest in or not. So I love time box because it forces a decision. It forces that reflection, right? This, again, it's kind of an agile principle here, right? It's like we want to do that reflection and we don't want to go too far down the wrong path. So, you know, let's time box it.
Well, in the spirit of honoring time boxes, we're almost to our hour here. That was a perfect segue for me. I had to take it.
Nice.
Any closing thoughts or parting words?
Yes. So look, it's interesting that the feedback from years and years now of lean UX teaching and speaking and consulting has been teams want to work this way. Companies don't want to let them work this way. And so what I believe Josh Seiden, my co-author, and I have done well in Sense and Respond is synthesize the key values from all of these modern management principles, lean and agile and design thinking and product discovery and so forth, product management, into a rallying cry for executives that says, look, you're in the software business. I don't care what you make. If you want to scale, if you want to grow, you're in the software business first. Managing a software-based business is different. You cannot manage it like a factory anymore, right? And so, and here's how everybody has to change. And so I feel like we've done a really good job of synthesizing that. So I think if you're working in an organization that's struggling to buy into this, I would encourage you to pick up a copy of Sense and Respond and you know, see if it resonates with your leaders and with your executives, if it starts to build at least more interesting and more productive conversations on the transformation front.
So that's a good point. So I wanted to also give you the opportunity to go ahead and plug the new book. So since you sort of mentioned it, you might as well go ahead and tell us about the new book and where we can get it. And we'll certainly post a link on the Uprising as well, so people can quickly find it.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and that's the best place to go. It's called Sense and Respond. It's three words. And again, I think that you'll find that it's a high level, it's kind of a mid-level book. So it's not a hyper-tactical book. There's some good tactics in there about planning and road mapping. That definitely seems to be the chapter that's resonating most with people. But it's really more of a kind of a manifesto and a rallying cry for leaders to wake up and to realize what's going on around them and to help build the kind of cultures that support this way of working.
Awesome. You have anything else that's upcoming besides the book? Any sort of speaking engagements or any other podcasts or anything else you want to promote that, you know, where people can find you?
Sure. I've got two public workshops coming up in the next couple of months. At the end of May, on May 31st, I'm teaching a public workshop in Barcelona.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm super awesome. Excited about that. There's an agile consulting shop there called Agilar, A-G-I-L-A-R, that's hosting me there. And then on June 20th and June 21st, Jeff Patton and I are once again teaching a two-day certified Scrum product owner course in New York City. This is the third class Jeff and I will have done together in New York. And they've been a ton of fun, really interesting, and they've all sold out. So if you're interested, I would definitely move on that relatively quickly as well. And those are all easily found on the internet.
Awesome. Awesome. So how else can people find you? Are you on Twitter? Sort of, you know, what other areas can people connect with you on?
Yep. So I'm on Twitter a lot. my username there is Jay Boogie, for better or for worse. That's a long story, but the short of it is, take your username seriously when you sign up for a new service. that's the moral of that story. And then I'm on Medium a lot these days too. I'm really enjoying Medium, posting, at least an article a month up on Medium, which again, I think it's Medium, my username. I think it's also Jay Boogie as well, 'cause they use a Twitter import there as well. So those are the two best places to find me. And obviously a Google search will get you other ways as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jeff. This was an awesome conversation. I hope it gets some people thinking about how to focus more on outcomes first and less on delivering stuff that doesn't matter.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it. And again, we publish these on Mondays. So everyone, if you haven't signed up already for the Agile Uprising Coalition, go out to the coalition and you can find all the podcasts out there, or you can subscribe to them as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.